This is 89.9 WWNO New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll sort through estimates of the city's shift in population with Dr. Allison Plyer of the Data Center. We'll also share a conversation about the formation of Bayou Metairie with Cityscapes columnist Richard Campanella. And today, the legendary Aaron Neville makes his French Quarter Festival debut. We'll have a quick chat about that and more. It's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. Since Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans has seen an annual increase in new residents to the city, but a new census report estimates a shift in population in New Orleans. Dr. Allison Plyer, Executive Director of the Data Center, joins me to sort through the data. Dr. Plyer, welcome.
It's great to be here.
Some figures released a couple weeks ago by the Census Bureau publication revealed data based on the city's population. Would you expound on that for us?
Sure. Well, just to clarify, the city population is growing. That's what the census estimates.
Okay.
And it is growing because we've had more births than deaths and because we've had more people moving in internationally than moving out. Now, where the loss has been is people moving out domestically. So there's been more people moving out domestically than moving in domestically. But all total, the city population continues to grow.
So domestically, can you explain how this is a turning point in the continued growth for the city?
Yeah, sure. The city population is now about 391,000 people. And every year since Katrina, we've seen a net positive of migration domestically. So more people moving here domestically than moving out. So this is the first year the census has estimated that there's more people moving away domestically than moving in. But the number is really small. I know a lot of folks have gotten worried about this number, but it's really only an estimated 759 people in terms of net migration out.
Okay. I guess it's the title that's just, you know, so intriguing. It sounds like it'll be a bigger number than 759.
Yeah, it does. You know, I think it sort of sounds alarming, but, you know, it's a really quite small number. Now, I think if this number next year were to be negative and next year were to be negative and to be even larger, you know, then that might be something to be concerned about. But the main thing any city needs to be worried about is whether it's growing or declining. And we are growing, and that means a very positive thing for the city. I think nobody needs to be overly concerned until we're declining.
Will domestic migration continue to be the source of growth for the city, you think?
Well, so what currently is the source of growth for the city is international migration,
okay.
And that being international migration that is documented, right? So anyone mm-hmm. who's undocumented isn't in these figures.
Right.
And then also births being larger than deaths. So, you know, in almost any situation, births are greater than deaths, but cities still sometimes decline because you have so much out-migration. And we're fortunate that we have net in-migration, particularly from international sources, that and more births than deaths, so that we're growing.
Now, the data shows that the state is continuing to grow as well, but face some struggles attracting new residents. Why is that?
Well, you know, the main thing that motivates individuals to move from one region to another is a job.
Right.
People move for jobs. And then the secondary reason they'll move is for social networks. So you might know a time, you know, you got a job offer in New York or something and you thought, do I know anybody who lives there or Baltimore or, you know, Tulsa? And so that's the reason people move from one place to another typically is for jobs. And in, you know, the case of Louisiana, our job market is a little bit less strong than some other places.
Right.
And so folks are getting attracted elsewhere.
And, you know, it's a little difficult as well to find affordable housing here in New Orleans alongside a job with growth. I believe that that's one of the issues as well.
Right. So, yeah. So you think about the whole population pie is at the metro level, right? So as jobs grow in the metro, population grows. Now, within the metro, people will decide where to live. Once they've come here for a job, they'll decide where to live based on affordable housing, schools, et cetera. And so when you think about low-wage jobs, it's really hard for people to live far away from low-wage jobs because they have to commute a long way. But they will if they can't get affordable housing near their low-wage jobs. And so one thing that, you know, New Orleans needs to really be realistic about is that we have a sector, tourism in particular, that generates a lot of low-wage jobs. And that's going to make it hard for folks to live near those low-wage jobs if our housing isn't affordable.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one word that I don't use too
too loosely, is estimates. So that's what this is. This is an estimate. And I know that the next U.S. census isn't until 2020. How likely is it that these estimates are correct?
That is a great question. And, you know, these estimates we know are always a little bit off. And the census does the best they can. But every 10 years, when they do the actual headcount, they compare their estimates to the actual headcount. And so we know for a fact these estimates will not be perfect. Mm-hmm. What we don't know is whether they're too high or too low. And that we can only guess at, make an informed guess at. So we'll find out more accurately what the population is after the 2020 census.
Okay. Did the data center identify any problems with the annual estimates that were just released?
Well, there's always these particular problems. The way the methodology works is that they start with the decennial census. They add births, they subtract deaths, and then they estimate people moving from one place to another based on IRS tax forms, change of address, and also Medicare change of address. And so people who don't get counted in are poor people who don't file taxes, undocumented folks, and even young professionals. Young professionals often will file their taxes back at mom's house in Ohio, and so then they're not counted as having moved here according to these census estimates, and they won't be counted until the 2020 census. So when we have those factors in our city, which we do, then it's likely that these estimates could be low.
Lastly, I want to ask, what are the state's most populous parishes?
It's not Orleans Parish since Katrina. It's now East Baton Rouge Parish. And also Jefferson Parish is larger than Orleans Parish.
Okay. And continued growth, I guess, we'll see in those parishes as well.
Well, Jefferson has had pretty stagnant growth. Orleans is still growing. So as though, even though people get, you know, a little concerned about this domestic out-migration, the main thing to keep in mind is that New Orleans is still growing its population.
And this is a trick question, Dr. Plyer. Is New Orleans growing or is it recovering?
Well, you know, I think nobody really knows that for sure,
right? Yeah.
And so I think, you know, if we take these estimates to be actual, then what we would think is that the growth is not a product of recovery, right? Because it's births and it's international immigration, and it's not domestic immigration. And we know that most people who evacuated did so domestically. So I would say that why this is something that folks get a little concerned about is it suggests that we're not recovering our population for the first time since Katrina.
That was Dr. Allison Plyer, Executive Director of the Data Center. Thank you for joining me today.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Every month, we talk to Richard Campanella about his Cityscapes column for NOLA.com. His most recent column is about Bayou Metairie, how it was formed by the Mississippi River, and how it impacted the development and landscape of Orleans Parish. WWNO's Jessica Rosegard shares this conversation.
I'm sitting here with Richard Campanella, geographer at the Tulane School of Architecture, to discuss his latest column, The Flow and Ebb of Bayou Metairie. Richard, thank you for joining me.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Tell me, how was Bayou Metairie formed?
Bayou Metairie formed starting 2,600 years ago when the Mississippi River, in jumping channels throughout south central and southeastern Louisiana, lunged in an eastern trajectory. And that is what brought it through the present-day area down Metairie Road, City Park Avenue, Gentilly Boulevard, out Chef Mentor, and into what is now eastern St. Bernard Parish. 1,200 years later, that channel jumps again into the current channel of the Mississippi going down to Plaquemines Parish. And in making that jump from one to the other, it left behind what we call an abandoned distributary. In other words, a relic channel plus the sediment that it had deposited. And that is present day what we call the Metairie-Gentilly Ridge. And in the focus of this particular article, Old Bayou Metairie.
So how did this formation of Bayou Metairie changed the landscape of this area?
Upon the arrival of indigenous peoples and later Europeans and Africans, the Bayou Metairie and Gentilly formed a back swamp ridge, really the only way to get across the back swamp without wading through it. And this would take you, if I could kind of paint a map for your listeners here, imagine over in River Ridge, Upland Avenue, the bayou would have broken off from the river there. It would have gone through Garden of Memory Cemetery along Airline Highway and then along Metairie Road and then into Orleans Parish, City Park Avenue, Gentilly Boulevard, and then out into what is now eastern New Orleans along a bayou channel that still exists, and we call that Bayou Sauvage.
How did the formation of Bayou Metairie impact the culture of the area?
Well, because it left behind this deposition of sediment, it formed the only dry passable road through the back swamp. So you would have had human movement through this area. You would have had indigenous accessing the Mississippi by coming along the Metairie Ridge, parallel, you know, what we now call Metairie Road, paralleling the bayou. Take that to the Esplanade Ridge, and that would get you to the Mississippi River. Upon European arrival here, this was high, dry, fertile ground, and it was pretty small in its geography and its spatial extent. So you would not have seen vast commodity plantations the way you would have seen in Uptown, sugarcane, rice, indigo. What you would have seen are small tenant farms doing intensive agriculture, dairy, rabbits, chickens, things like that. And that's where the term Metairie comes from. Metairie means a tenant farm, small farming, what we might call urban farming today.
Richard, how did Bayou Metairie and the formation thereby of Metairie Road impact traffic and getting around the area?
Well, in the early days of automobiles, Metairie Road was seen as a scenic excursion. And you had more and more people taking auto tours out to this winding, forested road. This is 19-teens, 1920s. It appeared in auto touring magazines. And also because it was high and dry, there were a number of nurseries along there, tree nurseries, so some of them the biggest in the South. The typical sort of land uses and industries you associate with the urban periphery in this era. Because of its outlying location, it also attracted some Sub Rosa activities, and this goes back to antebellum time. So in the early 20th century, there were kind of nightclubs and gambling places out there, to the point that citizens who lived there were in resistance to these places and actually incorporated very briefly as the town and later city of Metairie Ridge. It lasted only 1 year in the 1920s until a Louisiana State Supreme Court decision nullified it. And Metairie has been unincorporated ever since. But in the end, you had more and more traffic moving out there. This is before I-10. And that put increasing pressure on planners to widen it and thus get rid of this nuisance channel. And out of this came the eventual filling in and disappearance of most of the sections of Bayou Metairie.
So it not only had a geographic impact, but it had a social impact.
It had a social impact. It had an urbanistic impact, a topographical one. And you look at any satellite image and any map of New Orleans, look over to Metairie, and you'll see that winding road.
So in that sense of sort of that list, what do you think was the biggest impact of Bayou Metairie?
I would say in providing a high, dry geography that enabled land uses to appear in areas that they otherwise would not have. And these were fairgrounds, these were cemeteries, these were things that needed better drained areas in an environment that was otherwise swamp.
What remnants, I guess, remain today of Bayou Metairie?
Well, I'll get right to the answer there. And the biggest, best, most representative examples are the lagoons in Lower City Park. So with the suburbanization of Metairie, it was no longer scenic. It wasn't seen as amenity. And so gradually it was filled in. The last two portions that remained were the two that were landscaped and beautified. One was in Cities Park, and that's why that still exists. The other one existed clear up until the 1950s, and that was right along the southern edge of Metairie Cemetery. When you drive along Metairie Road, City Park Avenue, and you looked on the lakeside there, and there was a ornamentalized lake there called Horseshoe Lake, which was a remnant of Bayou Metairie. During the 1950s, that formed a bottleneck and people getting between Orleans and Jefferson Parish. And so it was expanded, Bayou Metairie was buried, and I make the point in the article that, in fact, you could say Bayou Metairie was buried at Metairie Cemetery.
There's so many remnants in the city then that harken back to this jump of the Mississippi River that's no longer really there.
Our cityscape is replete with these relics and vestiges and clues to the past. Every city has this, but ours is particularly rich in them. And I think of it as reading the cityscape, reading the landscape. That if you know what to look for, you could read this view right outside of our window here, almost like a book.
Richard Campanella, geographer with the Tulane School of Architecture. Latest column is The Flow and Ebb of Bayou Metairie on NOLA.com. Thank you for joining me.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Hey, did you catch Tripod This Morning with Lane Kaplan-Levenson? Well, in case you missed it, here's a quick tripod fact. According to Ryan Gray, an archaeologist at the University of New Orleans, there was an underground cemetery in the French Quarter, and some of the bodies are still there. Here's Lane Kaplan-Levenson. She recently stood at the corner of Burgundy and St. Peter Street, about 6 feet above bodies buried there. So, Lane, you were standing on dead people.
I was, Janae. I was.
Explain that to me.
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for having me on the show. Really appreciate it. But, you know, this is something that, for all the things people know about the French Quarter, both people that live here, both people that come and visit, people do not realize that there is a humongous cemetery underneath the French Quarter.
That's incredible to me. And the fact that back in the day, no one thought to remove the bones.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, one of the things is, you know, it is the very first cemetery of the city. So people look at St. Louis number 1 on the other side of Rampart as the first cemetery. It's the second cemetery. It's the first above ground. But, you know, when the city started out as just the French Quarter and those were the city limits, that's where the cemetery was. And as they expanded, they realized they needed to do something and have another cemetery. And so the church, who, you know, ruled the world at that time, were begging the city of New Orleans to not build on top of that cemetery. It was sacred grounds. There's bones there. There's bodies there. And the city was just like, we don't care.
But no sign of reverence.
No, I mean, they just did what they wanted.
Wow. And, you know, another thing that's completely fascinating to me is the fact that no matter what your race, in that first cemetery, everyone was there.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, that's one of the most significant findings that, you know, the archaeologists discovered when they did this dig, was seeing white folks, you know, people of color, indigenous peoples, all buried in this same cemetery. And some of that is because enslaved people were still considered Catholics by the church. And so they were all buried together. And that was the only cemetery of the city.
Right. And, you know, it kind of humbles you to a certain extent because, hey, when you die, I'm black, you're white, but we're all in the same cemetery.
That's right. It's kind of like, you know, the jig is up.
You know what I mean? And that is definitely a tripod fact.
Tripod fact. Thanks, Janae.
Thank you.
That was Lane Kaplan-Levenson. Catch Tripod Thursday mornings during Morning Edition and Monday evenings during All Things Considered. When you mention legendary singers and musicians from New Orleans, one voice is sure to stand out. With a career spanning over 5 decades, the legendary Aaron Neville shows no sign of slowing down. Neville joins us to talk about festival season and his latest album, Apache. Mr. Neville, welcome to All Things New Orleans.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you. Let's start by talking about your French Quarter Festival debut. Looking forward to it, I'm sure.
Oh, I am too. Big time. Me and the band.
Yeah, so I'd assume that you'd be performing a bunch of your classics, but some songs from your latest album, Apache, as well. Let's talk about that.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, we're doing a little bit of everything, you know. I think we have like 75 minutes, maybe a little longer, I don't know, but I would like for it to be longer.
I'm sure. Let's talk more about the album, Apache. You, along with Mr. Eric Krasno, guitarist, you guys put that together. Let's talk about the songs. Most of them were written by you, correct?
Yeah, all but two. Eric and Dave Gutter wrote Be Your Man and I Want to Love You. Everything else is from my pen, because I write on my cell phone.
Yeah, but I understand that back in the day, back in the 70s, you did actually have a journal where you wrote most of your poems.
You know, I used to have them on a piece of paper, and I had them in a paper bag, you know.
Yeah, so now you're going along with the 21st century.
Right. You didn't call it that.
So this album is actually, some people are calling it the other side of Neville. What was your inspiration behind it?
Well, for one thing, I wanted to put some of my poetry to music. And I hooked up with Eric Krasner and David Gutter, and we started talking and back and forth and coming up with ideas. And I would say yay or nay, you know, and mostly yays, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a real labor of love. It came out real good, and I'm proud of it. And I'm glad to have worked with Eric and Dave and the rest of the musicians on it.
I put out a hand to my heart and said, don't you feel how it's beating? Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. She held her child in her arms, but she was the one who was weeping.
So you're 76, and your voice seems as fresh as it was back in the day.
Well, I don't know about all that, but I'm still giving it the old college try, you know?
Yeah. Last year, during a CBS interview, you said that people are living a lot longer and not preparing for it. And I see photos and everything of you in the gym. Can you talk about that for a second?
Well, yeah. You know, like I also wrote it wasn't a poem. It was just something I had to say about people taking care of their bodies like they take care of their cars, you know? Because a lot of people take care of the car better than they take care of their body.
That's true.
Use it or lose it.
And you also say, you know, look good, sound good, and it seems to be working for you.
Well, like I say, I'm trying, and I keep God in the mix, you know?
You're also appearing at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival next month. Looking forward to that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking for all of it. I don't get down to New Orleans that often, so, you know. For the last few years, the only time I was down is for the Jazz Fest. I'm glad to be invited to the French Quarter Fest for the first time.
Yeah, so it's festival season, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the late, great Alan Toussaint. Let's talk about the relationship you guys shared.
Well, he's the cause of me being recording. He recorded my first record back in 1960.
Also helped out with one of my favorites, Hercules, correct?
Hercules?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was from 72, though. That was on the second go-around, because I was with Minute Records with Alan from 1960 to about 64. Then I had Tell Like It Is on Polo Record in 66, and hooked back up with Alan in 72, and then the album with the Hercules and Greatest Love and a lot of other cool songs.
All right. And, you know, with Mr. Toussaint's name being mentioned, you guys were actually the co-founders of the New Orleans Artists Against Hunger and Homelessness. Can you tell us a little bit about that nonprofit?
Well, you know, I was thinking about doing something. He was thinking about it at the same time. And so we wound up talking with Dutch Moriel, and he hooked us up to be able to do it. And we got a lot of the singers and musicians from New Orleans to sing that song. That was like 1985, I think, yeah. Because 84 is when I met Linda Ronstadt. And when we first started talking about doing a concert, I called her and asked her to come and be a part of it. She agreed. And that's when we first got a chance to sing together in Alan Toussaint's studio down at Seasaint. And that's how that began.
Okay.
But Alan was a part of my career, period, you know?
Yeah, yeah. We're definitely going to miss him during this time.
No doubt, yeah. I talked to his son Reg a lot, you know, and remind him that, you know, his father still lives and a lot of other people, you know.
Definitely. Well, Mr. Neville, thank you so much for your time on today, and we look forward to seeing you on festival stages.
Looking forward to it also. Thank you, dear.
That was the legendary Aaron Neville. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre, and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a topic or guest? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at WWNO.org. We'll be back with you next week here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.